Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello and welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and in this episode, I'm chatting to Canadian director Braden Croft. It's another one of my more epic interviews. This one goes on for over an hour, but none of it boring. I can reassure you, there's lots of fun stuff in there. We chat about his upcoming feature, True Fiction, which is set for release sometime in 2019. Our release date has not been set down yet. We also talk about his first two films, Hemorrhage and Feed the Gods. We talk about the realities of micro-budget filmmaking and the reality of doing pretty much everything yourself. You know, when it came to Hemorrhage, he did it all. He directed, wrote, cinematography, edited. It's, yeah, it very much totally Braden's film. We also talk about the difficulties he had on his second feature, Feed the Gods. There's a bunch of other stuff as well. We talk about the much debated term of elevated horror, his directorial influences, all that. It's interesting. It's packed with information. If you want to know a lot more about DIY filmmaking, then this is the episode for you. But I will not keep you any further, as we will roll right on to the interview with Braden. Hello, Braden. Nice to have you on the show.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
No problem. At some point, we're going to talk about the film that you currently have in production, True Fiction, which you're going to give us a bit of a tease for. But I think we'll start at the start and ask you, how, first of all, did you get into horror, and how did you get into actually filmmaking?
Yeah, so I guess with horror, as you well know, you start off watching horror movies as a kid. Yeah. You start thinking like, oh man, these are amazing. And one by one, you start to see them all.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God. You know, like you need to fill that gap somehow. And I think that's where filmmaking came in, is that I eventually came to a point where I was like, I have to make the movies I want to see, I guess. And from there, it was just, I guess, the typical story of try to go to films. I make your first feature and all of that.
So did you go to film school?
Did I cut out for a second there?
Yeah, just cut out for a second. Don't worry, I can edit.
That's all good. I was like, okay, pause for dramatic effect. Very good. Yeah, I did go to film school. I went to Vancouver Film School out on the West Coast there, obviously in Vancouver, mm-hmm. which is always funny when people ask, they go, so you went to film school? Yeah. I went to Vancouver. Oh, which school? Vancouver Film School. They're never too impressed with it. It's not like USC or anything, but it was a 1-year program. So they get you in and out in about 50 weeks. And I think Kevin Smith went there, and Neil Blomkamp, I know, was in like the VFX side of that.
Yeah.
I loved it. I come from a pretty blue collar family anyway. So, although it was like a lot of money for 1 year, it was still only 1 year versus like a 4-year USC education, which I don't know, going six figures in debt didn't really work out for people of my caliber, right? Or my social status.
Yeah. No, it doesn't sound too enticing, that laboring yourself with that amount of debt.
No, it's incredible. It reminds me of something. I think I read it in a just general filmmaking book, but one guy criticized filmmakers these days, being like, back in my day, we'd go to film school and we'd be the odd ones out. But nowadays, you have kids that would have been doctors or lawyers paying six figures to become filmmakers. So it's pretty incredible just to go to those schools alone, let alone make a career afterwards.
And how soon after that did you write your first film that would become Hemorrhage?
So when I first went, I was about 19. So give or take 3 or 4 years, I ended up coming back to my hometown of Sherwood Park in Alberta, Canada. Mm-hmm. And at 23, I made my first film for about $7,500. I was turning wrenches in my dad's garage that he owns. He has his little side business there. And yeah, basically, you know, you put your tail between your legs, live at home for a year, save up some money. And instead of spending it wisely, I went out and I made Hemorrhage, which turned out to be probably the best hasty decision I've ever made.
So what was that journey? How did that get from page to screen? I saw an interview with you. It said that you wrote the script in about 2010, and eventually it came out like 2 years later in 2012. What was the journey there?
Yeah, so I wrote the screenplay, you know, shortly after film school. So before I moved back, I was dating someone in the industry at that point. She was just starting out, and I always intended it for her to act in. Mm-hmm. And we since went our separate paths. I sat there with a script, basically a year into working a blue-collar job that was like soul-eating.
Yeah.
I thought like, okay, well, I gave it my best shot. I guess I'm not a filmmaker. And then it clicked. I was like, all right, I really hadn't tried to kick the can on this one. So let's just give her a go. And I scraped together what little money I had, bought the equipment. And I reached out to some local actors through a mock interview. I should probably say that in Vancouver at the time, I was working a day job that was a casting assistant. So I kind of knew what a casting felt like.
Yeah, yeah.
So from there, it's like, all right, I'll go to my dad's office. I'll dress it up. I'll say that my assistant's out for lunch or something and try to make this like as legit as it possibly could seem. And then you break the news to the actors. You're like, you got the role, but yeah, you're not going to get paid. See, because this is like at this level. Yeah. But everyone was really cool for it. Our lead actress was actually 15 at the time. So I know it sounds very weird, especially with like a 23-year-old guy in a room and you're like, okay, so you're cast. And she's like, well, I am on my my high school break, so I'll have time. My dad could drive me around. I was like, oh my God, what am I getting into?
So did you realize she was 15 straight away, or was that only after she said that you realized?
Oh, no. It never struck me. Like, she came in, she was really well composed, she was well spoken, and she went to some lessons in LA, so she was dropping names. Like, she's been around the town, and I was like, oh my God, I'm lucky to have this talented young woman that my guess would have been 18 to 20 years old. But yeah, at 15, it was a shock to me, but nevertheless, she's really cool about it. Her dad was really supportive. So it was never a question of like, is this too hard to handle or inappropriate? It was just super easy in that way. And then from there we found Alex Mackey, who became the lead. Yeah. And he was actually doing dinner theater. So I had a 15-year-old high school student and a dinner theater actor. So immediately I'm like, all right, there's obviously going to be no names in this, but they're so built for the role. Even Alex himself had his own experience with some of the subject matter. None of the murdering part, but more of like the psychological.
The psychological part, the mental illness part.
Yeah. And he's a really brilliant, eccentric guy to begin with. So he was a natural fit for it. And then we kind of hit the ground running and we shot it in and around my hometown there.
It wasn't just, I mean, looking at the IMDb page, the IMDb suggests that the budget was around $7,500. I don't know if IMDb are correct in that, but that's not just low budget filmmaking, that's micro budget filmmaking. How was that experience, you know, working with just such a little amount of money to try and spread it out over the course of a feature film?
It was an interesting experience. And I think, obviously, now I feel like I'm way too, I'm still ignorant. Let's be honest. I'm not the smartest guy in the room, but at the time I was very, very naive and I thought I could just do this thing. I remember, I think I spent about $5,000 for editing equipment, which included the computer, the software, and what have you, a camera and a lens. and some sound gear. And I've rented maybe some of the gripper equipment for about $2,500 for 3.5 weeks. Mm-hmm. So from there, I figured, how hard could this be? Like, I'll just kind of jump in. I studied cinematography and editing while I was in school, so I knew a lot of the technical parts.
Yeah.
And the only thing you don't anticipate when you do it all yourself, more or less, is that in the morning I would have to pack the gear and then get the set first thing, set it all up, have it ready for the actors, shoot the scene, and then when everyone went home, you break it down, throw it back in the truck, and go home. So you run like 5 to 6 hours of sleep per night if you're lucky. Mm-hmm. And just try not to put the barrel of something between your teeth and pull the trigger, because it was both like the most rewarding thing I've ever done, because sometimes you get those small wins on set and you would just be on fire because you're doing this on nothing. And then other days it would be like, it just feels like, how could I get this next day done? It's never going to work. This whole thing's going to be shit. And I'm going to disappoint the actors, my family. And then that'll be the proof my parents need to be like, maybe you should go to another career. So it was quite a lot.
Yeah. You certainly... were hands-on on the film, you know, looking at the credits, you know, it's written by, directed by, edited by, cinematography by, that seems like you really stretched yourself to do all those roles. I mean,
it's funny, like you mentioned, that most people's, especially nowadays in the DSLR movement and mm-hmm. DIY stuff, everyone kind of has their first film looking like that more and more. And things like color time, slating sound, this is an hour. I didn't slate a single shot because I knew I'd be editing. Mm-hmm. So when I got to the editing side of it, I would have maybe 5 takes of one shot and I would line up the sound the best I could on the sound waves versus what their lips are doing. Mm-hmm. And watch it through, and I'm like, great, okay, I synced this one, and then it would start to go out of sync, and I realized the actors were doing it so verbatim and so perfectly timed each time that there was such a minute difference between the takes that it may take me a full day to just sync up sound for one scene. Mm-hmm. So the editing process took about a year, I would say, and ever since then, it's almost like the most rudimentary skills to slate your sound on set, so... Nowadays, it's almost like a little bit of a privilege to have sound properly done, unlike how I did with Hemorrhage. It was like the ultimate learning lesson of, why the hell didn't you slit your sound? And so when you say multitasking, yeah, it's all those things you learn on set really quick. Even though you go to film school, it's like you forget dumb things and mm-hmm. learn hard lessons, you know, come post-production, but definitely helps.
And what were the kind of... things that you learned, mistakes you made, things that you think, oh man, you know, in projects going forward, I won't do that again. What was the learning curve?
The learning curve, scheduling was and is always something I'm not very good at. Like I really didn't have a first AD on my first film then. That was me. So our very first day on set was something like a 24-hour day. That we called one of our actors who was in the latter part of the day. He basically slept for 12 hours and then got up, had some lunch, went back to bed. And then, so it was, that was the part right away that I knew either I have to get an AD or I have to learn what my page counts are. Cause I kind of looked at my script in 90 pages. I'd go, okay, I could shoot 5 pages a day. So I'll just 5 pages here, 5 pages there, 5 pages here. Mm-hmm. Really like action heavy scenes. You may only shoot 2 days or 2 pages worth. So there's your day. And if you're trying to get 5 action heavy pages in, you're never going to shoot that. Yeah. So scheduling, slating your sound, what else? Any big mistakes? Really, there was no crew communication mistakes, which on my second film, you learn how to communicate better. Mm-hmm. So I guess a plus for shooting Hemorrhage was I didn't really have any big debates on set. I didn't have to convince anyone. If I wanted a light somewhere, you just move it. So things like that, you kind of learn along the way. And the more pieces you add, the more you kind of have to learn how to manage those. So I would say, yeah, sound and scheduling were the huge things that could have made a difference had I known better.
Would you, would that be your main tip for any first-time filmmaker, especially a DIY indie filmmaker like yourself?
Oh, man, if you want main tips, I got a bajillion. Read. Amazon is like the ultimate film school these days.
Yeah.
But besides recommending books, I'm looking over at like the massive shelf I got here, but From Real to Deal, I almost wish I read that book before I went to film school. So if there's any tips I could give anyone, it's study up and then go shoot, because you're going to learn all you're going to need to know in the first, you know, three little projects you do. You're just going to get swamped by it, and it's going to accelerate your learning curve so quickly. But yeah, knowledge is power. Don't skimp out on the reading. I think I do more reading than I do filming, like 100-fold. So
yeah. So I assume you have quite an extensive library over there of film books.
Yeah. If I know the podcast won't be able to see it, but
for the benefit of the listeners, Brandon has just shown me his bookshelf full of film books.
One of the I think one of the most valuable things too is just the state of mind that I guess you got to be in to you got to be equal parts audacious and equal parts stupid. Uh-huh. And I say that in a very like endearing term. The more naive you are, the better off you're going to be to make your own film. And I don't mean naive in the sense of like, I don't know what I'm doing. As far, you just have to have the fortitude, I guess, to forge ahead anyway. I personally know, and I've heard and read about, they try basically to read the dictionary before they learn to speak a language. And everyone knows you don't learn a language by reading every word in the dictionary. You kind of just get your toes wet and then you get corrected and you learn from there. So that was a big learning thing for me, was eventually just saying, screw it, I could go out and just do this. And you'll surprise yourself, because it's really not as hard as people think. It's just taking that first step, which is really hard.
For sure. Yeah. So after Hemorrhage came out, it seemed to get a decent response. It was at Fantasia Fest, and it got, I was just reading it, you know, a review that it got in Variety, that was a decent review that was said it was Hitchcockian, and were you pleased with the reaction with your first movie?
Oh yeah, I was ecstatic. But I mean, it wasn't, the whole ride wasn't quite as exciting as that sounds. Like that was the pinnacle, really. But when we made it and shot it, wrapped it up, after the year of editing and post-production work, we finally got it out to a festival. Mm-hmm. And you usually, once you release a film to a festival circuit, you got about a year to try and make the most of it.
Yeah.
So we ended up going out to a Toronto Independent Film Festival, which is technically TIFF, but it is not the TIFF everyone knows, right?
Yeah, so, right. Okay.
And I knew that going in, I was like, I'm not going to the TIFF, but it happens at the same time. There's going to be a lot of film lovers. Maybe we're going to get some like leak over into our film. Oh, and a couple of the actors came with me, and honest to God, it was so humbling, because we went to this festival in this very questionable theater, a lot of character, that's a nice way to put it, and there was maybe five people, three of which were me and a couple actors. Mm-hmm. So I was like, all right, this is what it's come to. All right, it's your first film, that's fine, accept it, move on, make another one. It wasn't until maybe about 11 months later that through word of mouth and through connections that I knew from Vancouver, one being an assistant producer, or kind of like a production assistant of sorts to a producing team, they saw the film, bundled it up with another movie called Toad Road by Jason Banker, who would kind of be in the mix of that whole circle, and we brought it to Fantasia. And Fantasia was where really everything kind of blew up. Yeah. Mitch Davis, I'm not sure if you've ever been to Fantasia, but Mitch Davis is like,
I have not. I'm not.
Oh, if you could ever make it, it's fantastic. And that's, okay. I couldn't even say enough good things about it. It was just a wonderful experience. And Mitch Davis is such like a, he's such a voice for independent filmmakers and people getting like their first step in the industry. And he certainly did that for Hemorrhage. And I can remember the first screening of it too, is that people piled in. I think we sold out a rather small theater, but there was a lot of industry and press. And I believe his name was Brad Anderson, but he was the writer for Variety. And my producer kind of nudged me, saying, hey, the guy in front of you, he writes for Variety, they'll probably do a review for this. And that made like the next 90 minutes of the film just be unbearably like nail biting. I just thought, oh my God, he's going to slaughter this thing. Does he know how much it was made for? I hope he takes it easy on me, blah, blah, blah. And the rest of that kind of went through like a lucid dream state. And a couple mornings later, we read it in Variety and he was, yeah, saying the nicest things about us. And all of a sudden, it was easier to pitch at the parties there to actually sell the film. And that's where I met Catherine Howe. And she was with Phase 4 that went to E1 Entertainment. And then the film was sold. And yeah, we largely got a really good response. And it all started really with the trust of the producers that I've met through Vancouver. And yeah, breaking into Fantasia with Mitch Davis, it was unreal.
That's awesome. You're moving on to your second movie, Feed the Gods, which is quite different. What made you go from a kind of psychological thriller about mental illness to a Bigfoot movie?
It sounds absurd, doesn't it? Well, at the time, it's hard to believe there was a time when Bigfoot films were not, you know, like a widely saturated thing in the market.
Yeah, like
when I first came up with it, I was like, all right, we're gonna do a found footage Blair Witch Sasquatch film and it's gonna be brilliant. And then sure enough, 6 months after getting knee deep into it, all these things pop up, like I think it was Willow's Creek, and I believe Eduardo Sanchez from Blair Witch was actually making his own. And I thought, shit, okay, now we're gonna have to switch it up. The wheels were already moving, we still want to make a movie. And that's, speaking of learning experiences, that was a learning experience in and of itself, was that after going to a festival, getting acknowledgement for being a filmmaker, you can kind of get this filmmaking high going that you want to ride. And part of that is you have to turn over more product, right?
Yeah.
So sure enough, that's what really pushed me into action. And I thought, is it a good enough idea? It was new at the time. And we went out, shot the film, and met fantastic people along the way, and our crew and our cast. But ultimately, yeah, I feel like I was too hasty. And if being hasty pushed Hemorrhage into existence, being hasty pushed this one into existence as well. Mm-hmm. But I feel like Feed the Gods, for multiple reasons, it was just like, it was a compromised project. Mm-hmm. And I definitely take the responsibility on that, because I think it was just being too high on filmmaking to stop and think, is this story mean as much to me as Hemorrhage did? Because if it doesn't, then maybe you should consider something else.
Yeah. So do you think, when you say it was compromised, were you just not as passionate about it, or was it a scheduling thing? Was it rushed?
It was a mix of a lot of small things. I know the relationship with my producers were, beforehand, when they brokered the sale of my first film, everything was very good. Come the second film, it's kind of like a two-pronged team. So half of the faction of that team, I was eye to eye with, but certain things started to pull, and I felt myself kind of compromising in ways like shooting a night scene in the day, which kind of flew under the radar for me. And then on the day, they're like, oh, we're shooting the scene. And when you're in the thick of it as a director, it just blindsided me. I was like, oh my God, I let this happen. Why are we shooting this in the day? So that was in reference to the climax of the film. And right away I thought, oh my God, looking back on it, in hindsight, is 2020. And I feel like I rushed the script. I feel like I compromised on some of the onset creative decisions that should have been more in line with the tone of the film. And ultimately, I think it was just the wrong film for me to make at the time.
Yeah.
Like, I've always loved psychological thrillers and horror films, and that's really what I like to sharpen my teeth on. And doing kind of a horror comedy alone is hard to pull off. Mm-hmm. So stepping into that zone too hastily with an undercooked script, which is fully on me, it was just a recipe to make a film that I feel probably underperformed or underdelivered on what I intended.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about there your love of kind of psychological horror, and I did see read an interview with you about Feed the Gods, where you very clearly stated that, like, even when you were making that movie, you didn't want it to be a trashy creature feature. You wanted it to be more about the characters.
Yeah. And into that mold. But I think, like, that's, it's funny when you go into it thinking like, all right, I will make the best Bigfoot film because it's, I don't know if the watermark for Bigfoot films is that high.
not really. There's not a lot of great Bigfoot movies.
No. And you don't stop to wonder like, well, maybe it's just a hard thing to pull off, period, no matter who you are. And of course you go in a little naive thinking you'll do it. And that's where you stumble. So yeah, it was too bad.
that's a shame. One of the things that also intrigued me about that interview was you talked about the influence of Uncle Bunmi on the movie, not the kind of the reference that you would naturally assume you would go to.
Oh yeah, when I watched Uncle Bunmi, that scene when the brother comes out of the forest and his eyes and everything's like very just kind of a super realist, fantastical scene there, where it's a conversation at a dinner table. And I thought, this is so unnerving and creepy. But again, as a young filmmaker, you overlook, like you can't just take that portion and inject it into something else. You really have to look at the whole piece, and the whole piece of that is such a measured tone by a very articulate filmmaker, and is a very dreamlike, almost like a Terrence Malick film. Yeah. So you can't really take like, all right, I'm gonna inject a little Terrence Malick into my broad comedy. Like, it's never gonna work. I mean, if it did, you're one hell of a filmmaker. That's crazy. But yeah. Uncle Bunmi, like that creep factor, that kind of not only visually, I thought the creature was amazing, but I also thought the mystique and the mythos behind what I can only assume is part of the culture there. I'm very ignorant. I'm an ignorant white guy as far as talking about what their ghost stories are like. But seeing that, I was like, can we do that in a North American sense? Can we tie in Native Americans and some of their mythos with that? So Uncle Bunmi was, that's what it kind of delivered to at least my vision.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm the same. I apologize to all my listeners. I am also an ignorant white guy. I cannot go into any more detail of Thai ghost stories. Obviously, Feed the Gods sounds like it was a frustrating experience, a compromised experience. Is there anything that you did get out of it that was positive, or you can point at and go like, yeah, I think I'm proud of that bit?
I think there were sequences. Like I know we did a little bit more action, so I like to dip my feet in that and saw like, okay, I pulled this off, I pulled that off. But more than that, it was my first experience with a real crew, a full-fleshed out crew. So working with those guys was a huge plus, and it would help me immensely with True Fiction, how to communicate, what to expect of, say, an assistant director on set, how to plan out a day, shot lists and scheduling. Like, there was a whole lot of more classical elements of filmmaking that I was forced to do on Feed the Gods that made the experience worthwhile, even though maybe the film didn't deliver on what I wanted it to deliver on.
Yeah, absolutely. I was also meaning to ask, as somebody who tends to have many roles in their films, tend to write and direct and edit your own films. I saw that you were the first AD on What Keeps Us Alive, the new Colin Meaneyhan film. What was that like, of just having the different role that you're like, not controlling the project?
Yeah, that was a great experience unto itself for many other reasons. It was a very mixed bag in the way of just taking on a role that I was so unaccustomed to. Uh-huh. And I told through mutual contacts with Mike Peterson and the Calgary group of filmmakers, they're plugged into Colin's work as well. Mm-hmm. And they were basically aware of me after meeting on the film Knuckleball as, behind the scenes, fellow director sort of thing.
Yeah.
And they reached out while they're in Toronto saying, could you come down? We want a first AD. And I flat out said, I've never done it. I've done it poorly on my first film. And on my second film, we did have an issue where we had to let go of one of our ADs and bring in a producer. So I think my whole knowledge of what an AD was supposed to do was very skewed by the fact that my producer was my AD on my second film. So the authority and the role that they played is not quite the same as what I would come to learn it should be on True Fiction. And that's not to say my producer wasn't a great AD. It was just, it's a different dynamic. So when she put her foot down and said, like, one shot, and then we move on, period. That was that. So coming back to Colin's movie, it was, A, I wasn't experienced enough. And B, it was more of a learning on the spot what you definitely don't do and what you do. So in a nutshell, though, I am a shit AD. I'm just going to put it out there. I should stick to directing. I should not be assistant directing. That is a whole different skill set that I respect immensely. And frankly, I'm glad Colin and them gave me the opportunity to help him on set. Because even as a director, watching him work, he's got his own unique style of filmmaking and communicating and whatnot, which I grew from. And I'm thankful for that. But all the same, I'm glad they had me out there. I'm glad they suffered my flat out ignorance that I did kind of profess before I came. They walked away with a great movie. So, I mean, all's well that ends well. I just hope I could have been a better AD at the time, but really all my prior experience, it was so skewed and so like unique to its own production history that,
How does it differ from like directing itself? How does it differ, ADing to directing?
From ADing to directing, what's the best? I like to speak in analogies sometimes to sound deeper than I am, but struggling to pull one for this. I guess directing, it's like you kind of had the freedom and the creativity to just say, I want this, figure out how to make it happen. Mm-hmm. In ADs, they're more of a taskmaster. So it's a very logical, very ABCD, very on the ball. They almost have to be the mothers of the set. And I did that on Hemorrhage, but at the same time, there's such an efficient protocol to do it the right way that to learn that and to be on top of the ball, I would wager to say that they work harder than directors.
Right.
So I don't know if that's answering your question, but what I learned on that was just like, it's logistics, balancing personalities, but balancing the creative needs of a director's vision. Mm-hmm. It's just such a demanding thing. Whereas as a director, say on True Fiction, it was just like, guys, I know what I need to cover it.
Yeah.
Make it happen, please. And then a great AD will be like, yeah, we could do that. And a poor AD would be, no, we got to compromise this and that. So our AD, by the way, on True Fiction was fantastic.
All right.
Yeah, he just crushed it. It was like, I had this, and I would almost throw too many things at him, seeing like, I know he's going to ask me to compromise. I just wanted to see his response. And he's like, okay, we'll do that. And then he'd screw off and make the crew do it.
yeah, absolutely. So the your first two films were produced by Random Bench Productions. This film, your latest film that's it's in post-production now, or is produced by the 775 Media. What caused the jump there? You know, how did you get a relationship with them? And
So to fast forward, or rather rewind to the past, when I went to Fantasia with Random Bench, it was a new relationship. They did broker my sale. So they technically didn't do the on the foot producing that they would eventually do for Feed the Gods. Mm-hmm. But through them, I did meet Mike Peterson, who you've spoken with before on Knuckleball.
Yeah, he was on a previous episode of the podcast. Yeah.
He was there with Lloyd the Conqueror. Mm-hmm. And in passing, he just said, oh, we're two Alberta filmmakers, you know. Hey, how you doing? Add you on Facebook and we'll speak in 5 or 6 years when we come to make True Fiction. But we initially had True Fiction was conceptualized before the Bigfoot film.
Yeah.
Gods. And I did pitch it to Random Bench and they said, oh yeah, we want this. But I knew right away that that was something I really had to buckle down and get right on paper before I could do anything. So instead we shot Feed the Gods. And after that experience, I had a real kind of, I'm not going to say breakdown because I wasn't like, you couldn't talk to me sort of thing. It was just more of a reassessment of what I wanted to do as a filmmaker. And part of that was finding people that lined up with me creatively and practically to make a film the way I want to make it. Mm-hmm. And so from there, I didn't want to be beholden to one group of people. And in this case, it was Random Bench, who did treat me well. But we did have our creative differences in how we'd like to operate. So I held out, refined the script over the course of a couple of years. And Mike reached out to me saying, you know, hey, how you doing? Do you got any projects in the works? And I threw him True Fiction. He bit. And little did I know that they were putting together a production company of their own, which would become 775. And then, the rest is history. He passed me on to a producing partner of his, Julian Black Antelope. We got on like gangbusters, and then we went off and we made it with 775. It was a long process in the making, but once we got all those things in line, it just felt right. It felt like what filmmaking should feel like, in my opinion, which is organic and symbiotic between the people and not a constant clashing of personalities or directions.
Of course, one of the producers from 775, Julian Black Antelope, as you mentioned, also he is an actor and stars in the movie. How was that having that relationship as a director and an actor and the director and producer?
Oh, it was great. It was great. It was, what could I say about Julian? That guy, he's kind of like an older brother. At first, I was like, this guy is so quintessentially akin to my family's male figureheads. He just had the personality that we gelled, right? And being an actor, he had contacts already. He knew kind of the process of what a director would go through, much like Mike does, because he's a director too.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was great because he really afforded me such a wide array of flexibility to capture what I wanted to do with it. Whereas some producers that are only producers, they have bottom lines they want to stick to. They have certain things they have to check off the list in order for them to feel comfortable moving forward with the project. But Julian was like, hey man, you got a vision? Let's just go with it. I'm going to give you what you need. And he really stayed out of the way in what my vision was, but he was also there to support me and back me for whatever things I felt I needed, which is very, it sounds like that should be an obvious thing with producers, but more often than not, there is a conflict there. So that was great. And Julian is recently, I'll pump him up because he deserves it. He was just in Jeremy Saulnier's Hold the Dark, which premiered at TIFF.
Yeah.
He's getting great responses from it. The film's doing great. And couldn't happen to a nicer guy. And not only did Jeremy Saulnier, as you know, he's done Green Room, and
Blue Ruin. Yeah.
And those were two films that I came into True Fiction being like, this is the dude that makes the films I love. And that I like that. Do you get these type of films, Julian? And he's like, man, I was just on that flipping movie. I know Jeremy personally. And we shot in the studio in Calgary that he shot in for a portion of our film. And he showed me the desk he sat in. So immediately I'm like, I feel like I'm sitting in a master's seat. Like months after they shoot Hold the Dark, I was like, I don't know. I got this energy now. And yeah, so he's got great experience, great insight. And he was just the same, cut from the same cloth I am really when it comes to the taste in film. So it was great.
Absolutely. Was he involved in any of the casting or anything? Because I noticed that one of your other main actors is John Cassini, who also co-stars in Blackstone, has been in Blackstone with Julian. And I was wondering if that came about through Julian.
Yeah. You've done your research, man. That's good. That's good. He, and being, I know this is what he is, but... Yeah. In case I'm wrong, disclaimer, I believe he's Blackfoot, Native American there. And he said, I have a vision of John Cassini playing this role. Mm-hmm. Like John Cassini, I know the name. I've been in Vancouver. He's a big Vancouver player. He was very adamant that I at least consider the guy. And I admit I was a little hesitant because I was like, yeah, I'm getting this kind of New York cop gangster vibe from him. I'm not sure if that's what I have in mind for Caleb.
Yeah.
And we finally saw him read. It was a lot of back and forth. And it wasn't until I met John in person and saw him the first day of set, him acting, and the ideas he was coming up with even before we shot, that I was like, damn it, Julian's right again. Like, it's a great choice. So yeah, he did have a huge hand in casting a lot of the people. Never by force, it was always by suggestion, but Cassini's almost...
Sorry, you broke up a little bit.
I trusted in that, and it really paid off because John's a great guy and great performer. Oh, sure. Where did I leave off?
You said that Julian had a big hand in getting John Cassini into the role, and then I presume you were talking a little bit about John Cassini's performance within the movie.
Yeah. So he did have... Julian had the vision of Cassini filming this role, and the more I talked to John, the more I saw him on set, the more his ideas came out and his choices were made, the more it was obvious that this was the best choice by far that we could have gone with. And yeah, Julian was a huge part of that, and our casting director eventually pushed us toward Sarah Garcia. She was one of the top five we had, and she stood out far and away from a lot of the other reads that we got from other actresses, who are great too, but sometimes weird because everything kind of feels like, okay, maybe this, maybe that. But when the Sarah Garcias of the world and John Cassini's come in and they read that, it clicks. It's almost like, it can't be anyone else now. I have to have these people.
Yeah.
It was a great fit.
Excellent. How much more can you tell? I mean, other than the kind of basic synopsis, of John Cassini playing this author, Caleb, and Sarah Garcia playing this other character, obviously goes to see him and is a fan, and then is tasked with these psychological experiments. That's the basic synopsis I've read. Is there anything else you can kind of tell us about the movie, or about when the movie will be we'll be seeing the movie?
Sure. Yeah, I'll try and freewheel on that. For your viewers or your listeners, the synopsis is basically a young woman gets a chance to write for or assist her hero in writing his next novel. Mm-hmm. So it's very much kind of like a Stephen King-esque figure. No one's seen his face. He's very mysterious. He had his heyday and now he's trying to recapture that. So she goes out to his mansion and eventually agrees to embark in a game that would push her psychologically to influence his next novel. So it's very much like the film The Haunting.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, the Robert Wise film in the 60s where it's like, we're going to play a game and I'm going to scare the shit out of you. And is it all really a game? Are you really in danger? So it's very much a Misery meets Hard Candy meets The Haunting.
Wow.
And yeah, I think without like getting too heavy into it, I really do feel like my vision was as close to being captured as it could ever possibly be. Like watching the footage back, I'm like, there's not a damn thing I would change about it. Yeah. It was shot the way I wanted it shot. It was acted with the performances that were great. I got every little bit I wanted, and hopefully people get a really good elevated horror film, psychological thriller vibe from it.
It's interesting that you say elevated horror. It seems to be a much debated term. I think some people view it as kind of just critical snobbery of anything that gets good reviews is an elevated horror. Where do you land on that debate? Is that your kind of type of horror movie that draws you in?
That's funny you mentioned that. It is kind of a pretentious buzzword lately, right? Like people say that and they go, oh, it's going to be one of those films. Or like A24 or A24.
Yeah.
Obviously, they're kind of library. They're building it around the elevated genre world. Yeah. But I don't know. My personal interpretation of it, I don't see... There's even films that are like a genre exercise. Just a couple weeks ago, I saw The Last Shift.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about the cop, the female cop in the defunct precinct, and then she starts seeing hauntings and whatnot. And it really is just an exercise in suspense and terror. So I think people slough that off as, oh, that's not elevated genre. But I think even those, for lack of a better term, one-dimensional horror films, if they're done with finesse and craft and they put storytelling above, say, exploitive elements, mm-hmm. that to me would be an elevated film, an elevated horror film.
Yeah.
If you're a damn good director, it's a damn good script. The performances are great and you deliver you know, the craft at such a high level, that to me is elevated. It doesn't mean it has to be long. It doesn't mean it has to be pretentious. It doesn't mean it has to touch on social issues at all. It's just, are you delivering at a high, high capacity what the genre calls for? And I mean, if you want to go so far to say that, did you turn it upside down? Did you invert it? Well, that's just an even better film that you would call an elevated horror film. So I wouldn't see it as derogatory. I think even the simplest of films can be high art.
Yeah. I would agree. I would agree with that. And I think there's a lot of, I like those films that are kind of given that tag as elevated horror. I think some people probably get a bit annoyed just purely for the fact I think it's the way certain critics write about it might be what causes annoyance of like, as if that kind of film has just arrived with the kind of A24 movies and like, you know, and then of course there's all these movies like The Shining and Rosemary's Baby and all those, you know, things that are like elevated horror, you know, that is not just kind of, you know, schlocky.
Yeah, exactly. Well, shit, even Roger Corman's Poe films, like, a good handful of those, they, in a way, those are elevated horror films. And you're right, Rosemary's Baby, I love those films. The Exorcist, the 70s horror alone, every one of those films were so unique, and your voice is so bold. That's kind of a crucial ingredient, too, is like, is this, what would you call, it doesn't necessarily have to be unique, but it has to feel uncompromised. It has to feel like a very bold, singular vision of a storyteller. And to me, that's an elevated film, period. And if you do it in genre, now you got an elevated genre film. As soon as it becomes homogenized, it does feel like a wasted opportunity. And I know there is compromises, especially with big studio films, but even guys like Mike Flanagan making films like Hush for Netflix or Ouija 2, like he's still such a unique filmmaker with a great vision that I would call he's elevating commercial genre films. That's just through sheer craft, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And as long as there's a vision there and there's a kind of heart and passion going into that, and you can tell that there's a craft there, I think that's all you need to be kind of elevated or whatever that means to people.
Yeah. Genres, horror films as a genre alone are broadening their parameters. Not every genre film has to have, or a horror film rather, has to have a survivor girl. It could be a mix, like The Invitation, right?
Yeah.
Which I thought was probably the best horror film I've seen in the last 5 to 10 years. So you could do a lot of things. I think as long as you keep that scope of what a horror film is, like Wake and Fright, I just watched the other day, the Australian film.
Oh yeah, from the 70s, early 70s, yeah.
Yeah, like there's such a broad topic of what can be considered horror, and it could be psychological, it could be social, it could be institutional, so many different ways that I think the more horror film fanatics embrace that, the more you could see individual unique visions come to life. And I think that's where the real gems will come from, is pushing those envelopes and seeing these new ideas enter the arena of a horror film.
Yeah. And I think that's great. You know, I think we should have a very broad definition of horror. And there's a lot of movies that seem to be, I've heard people, you know, question whether The Witch is a horror movie or question whether Get Out is a horror movie or whatever. And I always think it's bizarre, you know, that they are horror movies. They've got other elements, but they're horror movies, you know?
Oh, completely, completely. It's like the debate with Silence of the Lambs. It's like, well, no, it's not a lowly horror. It's a thriller. Well, yeah, it's a thriller too, but it's also a horror. I mean, you don't have someone eating humans and pulling off faces and, you know, girls in holes while you squeak at your dog, you know, putting the lotion in the basket and all that shit. Like, it's so much a horror.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the director, Jonathan Demme, the late Jonathan Demme, actually always said it was a horror. I think it was more marketing people because they thought it wouldn't get the Oscar if they'd mentioned it was a horror movie. And yeah. It did get the Oscar, so back in the day. So, you know, like, obviously it worked in those terms.
yeah, exactly. And it's nice to see more, like, I know Jonathan Demme's kind of the quintessential director where he could flip-flop to any genre and really master it, much like Kubrick can.
Yeah.
But it's great to see those guys step into that world because it does legitimize, in a way, the genre. And as much as, you know, Wes Craven is a staple, John Carpenter is a staple, they've always been undercut because, for one reason or another, people poo-poo their films because they're strictly, quote-unquote, genre directors or strictly horror film directors.
Yeah.
But I think it's such a... Every director should make a horror film. That's my opinion. I think everyone should at least make one because, damn, if Jordan Peele could crank out Get Out, and that's an awesome movie. I'm not sure if the hype, I would agree to the level it's been hyped, but no question, is it one of the better movies of that year? It's a fantastic horror film. And that's from one of the funniest guys out there.
Yeah.
If that's coming from his mind, I want to see the other people out there too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I would definitely agree. More people should make horror movies. Like, a broader range of people should make horror movies. Sure. But it's also a shame that, you know, some people who are genre filmmakers, who are horror filmmakers, do get overlooked if they do just stick to that genre.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I can't remember the fella's name right now off the top of my head, but again, I watched Killing of a Sacred Deer the other day, and he's done Dogtooth and whatnot in Alps.
Oh, yeah, Yorgos Lanthimos.
That's right. Like, he that's an elevated art house genre director, in my opinion.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
Awesome. I would love to see more of that stuff.
Yeah. So, are those the kind of directors that inspire you? Having looked at your bookshelf with all the film books, I'm presuming it's quite a long list. But if you could give us a sample list of some of the people who have inspired or influenced you directorially,
for sure. This is where I'll like lose some of your more eccentric podcast listeners, because although I do love very obscure titles, some of my favorite directors are like the obvious guys.
Yeah,
and for different reasons. But like the Martin Scorsese's of the world are unreal. His films from like, you know, 75 off to mid-80s are just untouchable, in my opinion. As funny as it sounds, like I don't share the same sentiment of filmmaking he does, but the Steven Spielberg, the way he constructs a sequence, like a suspense sequence, is, in my opinion, better than any of the horror filmmakers I could think of. Like, if you've seen Duel, if you've seen some portions of his more intense films like Jaws and stuff, like, they write him off as very whimsical and very kind of light kiddie play. But if he ever decided to do a David Fincher-esque kind of downer hardcore film, I think he would blow people away with how effective his craft is. So those two are very obvious for me. David Lynch is huge. I think that's a must for every horror film fanatic, even though he doesn't explicitly make horror films. Eraserhead, if you don't watch that and get nightmares from that, I don't know which film will give you nightmares. Lost Highway has some of the best horror scenes ever. The one dumpster scene in Mulholland Drive. Oh my God. You see it coming. He tells you something scary is going to happen. You're prepared for it the whole time.
Yeah.
You'll shit your pants.
Dennis Hopper's whole performance in Blue Velvet, and it's very
like, if that doesn't unnerve you, like, it's funny that he has he just doesn't care to define himself in any way, but really, he could claim to be one of the best horror directors, and I don't know if I would disagree.
There's definitely strong horror elements to a lot of his films.
Completely. But I mean, to shake things up and to flip the coin and talk about other types of filmmakers, I even, like, John Hughes, I've said it before in like Fangoria, and I don't think it was ever printed, but I like Breakfast Club. I look at those films, I'm like, I don't know if I can make that movie. Not because I hate it, it's because I love it. But it's such a different type of filmmaking that yeah. accustomed to where I would normally watch that. Being that optimistic and hopeful and non-cynical and wholesome, having that, it kind of cleanses the palate, especially when you're a horror film director. That I would recommend that to any horror filmmaker, period, just to get, like I said, you cleanse the palate, man. Like, check out these happy films for a bit.
Yeah, just have a different feel. And yeah, I mean, like, I'm a massive horror fan, but I can also say that, you know, like, the John Hughes movies of the 80s are really good, you know. Like, you know, it's really just fun movies.
Yeah. I usually, when people ask me what are my favorite filmmakers, I usually have a hard time stating it, because you're right, there are so many. Mm-hmm. But it's more so, I find it easier to narrow down my favorite films and go from there, like Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, like Martin Scorsese, he's on my top for that. David Fincher's Seven, like Jonathan Demme did great with Silence of the Lambs, and Hitch had all of his films too, but obviously Psycho stands out as a massive horror influence. Kubrick probably has the best library of any filmmaker ever.
Yeah.
So, although they're obvious, it's like they're obvious for a reason.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. You know, so sometimes it can be a bit of a trap of you just like going kind of cult or for the sake of it, or, you know, like sometimes my favorite horror movie is The Shining, and sometimes I think, oh, that's a bit of a boring choice, but it's a masterpiece. And you know, people call it a masterpiece for a reason, because it is.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you always have those names in your back pocket, like, oh, who's your favorite director? And if they want like a pretentious answer, you're just kind of like, well, I really like Beat Takashi and like all of his films. Violent Cop is fantastic. Have you seen it? You haven't? Oh, you must suck at film. You know, like, you got to have those in your back pocket too. Like,
yeah.
Absolutely, Iron Man is the best movie I've ever seen. 8mm classic. But yeah, they're all great, man. That's true.
But I mean, yeah, I mean, on saying that, both Violent Cop and Tessa and Iron Man are great movies. And if listeners haven't seen them, I would definitely recommend that they check them out.
Yeah, it's wild. It's like, even guys like John Waters, like, his films freak me out, man. They're just so bloody weird. And would I say I ever want to make a John Waters film? Probably not. At the same time, is it essential viewing? Yeah. Go check it out. And God, who's the other guy? Like,
I like to think that lots of people who have gone to see Hairspray the musical have then gone back and checked out John Waters' filmography and like rented or bought like Pink Flamingos or downloaded like one of those early movies and then just been like totally shocked.
What is this?
This guy made Hairspray.
Yeah, totally. Oh God, another recent director right now that blows me away every time I see her films is Lynn Ramsey, who I think, I mean, Scottish too, is she not?
Yeah, she's Scottish. I mean, like, obviously her last couple of movies have been set in America, in America, but yeah, she's a Scottish filmmaker, and one of her early movies, Ratcatcher, is in Scotland, and I would recommend that if you've not seen that.
Over in Cavalier, I always say it wrong. But she's got a great style and sense of her direction. And I like most people in North America, I was introduced with We Need to Talk About Kevin, but watching that, I was like, I don't know if I want to ever have kids now. And if that's not a horror movie, like, holy shit.
Yeah, that's definitely, I would say that's definitely a horror movie, We Need to Talk About Kevin. And even her latest picture, you know, You Were Never Really Here, as got horror elements too.
Yeah, that was great. So it's nice to see those filmmakers come into the fold to be more commercially viable and have those wide releases. But I guess my last name I'll give you for a great director, who I don't even know who funds his films, because he's so out there but so wonderful, is Todd Solondz. So for Happiness and I think it's, what is it, War and Peace Time, Palindromes. My God, that guy, I don't know how he gets into like a pitch meeting and says, yeah, I want to make a movie about a guy that like kills young men or young boys And it's gonna be great. People are gonna watch this shit. his craft is unparalleled. Like the dream sequence in that film is one of my favorite scenes in all of cinema, when he's just, everything's very saturated and picnic and couples on benches kissing, and he walks in with like that bland face and just starts toasting people with a gun, and you're like, what the hell is happening? What is this? It's insane.
I'm not sure who he pitches his movies to either, but a brilliant filmmaker, and it made some really excellent black comedies.
yeah the blackest of comedies. So I'm just glad to get made, period. I don't know who funds them, but good on them, because that we're all better for it, I think.
We will return to your latest movie, True Fiction, and can we do you know when it's going to be coming out?
That's always a tough one. A long story short, we did have to kind of push our dates back for the production, post-production of it. And that's more of a numbers pushing thing. But I know we hope to try and get it to some of the festivals that would break, I guess, fall and summertime of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
So give or take, if we have a decent festival run and that lasts up until the latter part of 2019, maybe early 2020,
mm-hmm.
I would hope that the film would start hitting shelves or VOD or what have you come late 2019, early 2020, which seems like ages from now. Holy crap.
It's one of those things, I'm sure it'll kind of soon come around, you know?
Soon enough. But never soon enough, I guess. I wish there was a quicker turnaround on those.
I certainly look forward to checking out whenever it does come out, and if it lands at a festival near here, you know.
I'm crossing my fingers, even if it gets to very modest festivals, very underseen festivals. I don't care if they could call me a flight out. I want to go see it. I want to come to check out people in, like yourself, in Scotland, or see what they have to offer there. Because audiences in different places could be so unique in their own way, and what they appreciate and what you get from it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would recommend both Glasgow Fright Fest and Dead by Dawn, the Dead by Dawn Horror Film Festival here in Edinburgh, if you're looking at Scottish festivals, which they're the two Scottish horror festivals.
Yeah, and they're no joke in amongst themselves. Like, I hear those names all the time, so... I haven't been. I hear they're amazing, but God, if I ever have the opportunity, I would love to bring it there. That'd be great.
Excellent. Well, if you do, hopefully I'll see you there. And I think that brings us to the end of our time. And thanks again for being on the show.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks so much for having me on. It was a pleasure.
That was my guest, Braden Croft there, who I'd like to thank once again for being such a great interviewee. I'd also like to give a special thank you to friend of the show, Mike Peterson, who put me in touch with Braden. And of course, I always like to give you, listener, a thank you, a big thank you for tuning in to this latest episode of New Horror Express. Remember to tune in to the next episode, where we keep the Canadian flavor rolling with director Rob Grant. And you can always check out all the previous episodes of New Horror Express on iTunes and Stitcher, where we would be greatly appreciative if you rate, review, and subscribe to us. The podcast is also available wherever good podcasts are available. Remember, you can also give us a like on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. But that's all for this episode. There's no more episode left, so it only leaves for me to say, cheerio, and I'll see you next time.